sleep. To be.
I'm recording.
I'm recording on mine.
Well, hello everyone.
Hello, girls, gays, and theys.
Welcome to the final episode of this season of Rate Debate Recall. Oh my god. I'm Sammy.
That
Michelle.
Is so crazy.
I know, it is really crazy.
And I'm Logan Keller.
As I said, we're back for episode 16. I can't believe it. And I do have one final question for you. So, hey, Logan.
Bring it. Yes, Sammy.
Have you ever had a child that you maybe didn't tell anyone about? Like, maybe you wanted to propose to someone, but you didn't tell them about your children beforehand, or maybe your boyfriend kicked you out of a band and you were pregnant, but you didn't tell them about it. Has that ever happened to you?
You know, neither of those situations ring a bell, but... Yeah, I don't think I have. I can't say that I have any children yet. I will have like 10.
Oh yeah, no doubt. I don't either, and I can't say that I will have 10, but maybe I'll have some someday. Anyway, that's what our show today is about. So again, just to explain a little bit what Rate Debate Recreate is, if you're first tuning in our final episode... each week, Logan and I each pick a show, a musical, and we rate it on a scale of 1 to 10 and debate which one is better. And then after that, we'll kind of engage in a little bit of friendly discussion, and then we'll think of one aspect of the show that we would change and recreate it. And as we said, we have a category each week, and this week that category is shows where the protagonist has surprise children. My show is South Pacific.
And my show is Dreamgirls.
Excellent. This is going to be a good final episode, I think.
Yeah, I like that we're closing out with this.
Yeah, there's a lot. There is a lot to talk about for both of these shows.
For real.
So I'm excited. But I'll get us started. Let's move into a little bit of summary, so we'll both kind of go over each show. So I'll start with South Pacific. So South Pacific is a musical with music by Richard Rodgers, lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II. I don't know if you ever heard of them. They're not very well known. But the book is also by Hammerstein and Joshua Logan. And it premiered in 1949, and it was a massive, massive, massive hit. So the musical is based on the 1947 book Tales of the South Pacific by James A. Michener. I don't know if I said that right, but props to him. And Rodgers and Hammerstein, their goal in creating this musical was to, A, create a musical that was financially successful, because, of course, and also to create a show that would send a strong progressive message about racism. And it was really successful in 1949. It won 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, Best Score, Best Libretto, and it won all four acting categories. So it really swept up.
Today is still the only show that's ever done that. That's won all four acting categories.
Hamilton almost did, right? But then Cynthia Erivo, yeah.
By Philippa Sue, yeah.
Yeah. Man, okay, well, I'm going to try to keep this summary as short as possible. It's like a 3-hour show. But it centers around basically two main love stories, so I'll kind of focus on those and try to keep it short. So you've got Nellie and Emile, and the show takes place on an island in the South Pacific. I'm recording something. Please go away for a minute. Sorry. Okay, sorry about that.
Sagittarius.
I know. Alright, so the show, it takes place on an island in the South Pacific, and it's during World War II. The story follows Nellie Forbes, she's a naval nurse from Little Rock, Arkansas, and her budding relationship with a French plantation owner named Emile Debec. And he wants her to marry him, but he has to tell her some things first, namely that he killed a man, and that's why he had to leave France. So she says she'll think about it, and then she leaves. And after she leaves, it's revealed that he has two half-Polynesian children, which he has not told her about. There are some hemming and hawing and lots of talk about progressive ideals. She agrees to marry him, and then when he introduces her to his children, she is absolutely disgusted that they are not fully white and runs off. So Emile repeatedly tries to reconcile with her, but she just can't get past her prejudices. And at some point, Emile is sent on a mission or agrees to go on a mission for the U.S. Army, and he goes missing. And Nellie kind of realizes the error of her ways, and she begins to bond with his children, and then he comes back, and they live happily ever after on the island. And then the other kind of central couple, and they have like a third component of their relationship. So the other three main characters that I'll talk about are Liat, Cable, Lieutenant Cable, and Bloody Mary. So Bloody Mary is a native Tonkinese woman who lives on the island, and she goes around selling her wares to the American soldiers. She's a teenage daughter, teenage being the operative word there, named Liat. And Lieutenant Cable shows up. He's an American soldier. He shows up on the island at the beginning of the show. He's been sent there as part of some mission, and he wants to recruit a meal for the mission. Bloody Mary finds Cable very handsome, and when he travels to Bali High, which is another island, she introduces him to Liat, and they have sex and fall in love. we'll get into it. Bloody Mary wants Cable to marry her daughter, and she believes that that is the best way to give her daughter a better life. Even though Cable loves Liat, he can't get over his prejudices about her being not white, and he refuses. So Bloody Mary is angry about this, and she's like, well, I'll just marry her off to a French planter instead. And Cable is distraught at the thought of that, and after speaking with Emile, kind of interrogating his ingrained racism, he vows that he will not go home, but he will stay on the island because everything he loves is on the island. But first, he has to go on that mission with Emile, and he dies. So, Liat refuses to marry anyone else. It's very sad. But that's South Pacific, in a nutshell. And I watched the production with Kelly O'Hara, and I think his name is Paulo Sot. I'm not sure how to say his last name. I think he's a Brazilian actor. But I'm going to give that production a 7.5 out of 10. I think if I was just writing the musical as a whole, I might go a little lower, but I liked certain parts of that production a lot.
7.5 out of 10.
Oh, shit. Oh, man.
You can think of it while I do my summary if you want.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, I'll, yeah, just tell it to me before I do my dream,
okay.
Or my
I will.
Rating. Okay, Dream Girls. So, Dreamgirls follows the Dreamettes, which is a trio composed of Effie, who's the lead singer, Dina, and Laurel, and it kind of shows their rise to fame and the results of that and consequences. It's considered to be heavily based off of the Supremes IRL group led by Diana Ross, but the creative, the creative team behind this show deny that, which is kind of weird because we'll get into this later, but the similarities are like uncanny isn't even the right word
yeah.
to describe the similarities. Anyway, we start off by seeing the Dreamettes perform at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, which is about a 5-minute walk from where I am recording this right now in my apartment. And they're in a talent show. And they're basically trying to get their break. They don't end up winning, even though they slay. But after the show, a car salesman, Curtis, approaches them and offers to be their manager. He gets them a gig as backup singers for this guy named Jimmy Early, who's also kind of like on the rise. And combined, they make a really good group together. They rise up the charts with some Motown-inspired songs. Eventually, they get big enough that the Dreamettes are ready to do their own thing. But when they do, Curtis, as their manager, decides that Dina should be the lead, not Effie, mm-hmm. despite her being the lead the whole time and having the best voice. And the reasoning is because of her softer commercial voice, which is more palatable to white audiences. And that, I think, is a common theme, is like the Dream Girls and Black artists in this show needing to make sacrifices mm-hmm. to make themselves palatable. Anyway, after that, Effie gets fed up and quits. By the way, she's been having a thing with Jimmy the whole time. Curtis ends up marrying Dina. The Dream Girls replace Effie, and they end up having like extreme massive success. They top the charts. They become like a really famous group. Dina gets like not only as the lead of this group, but she's also doing movie deals and is just like a well-known person, getting all these accolades. 10 years later, which is when the second act takes place, Effie is trying to get back on her feet by getting into the music scenes. So she releases some songs, one of which Curtis steals and has the Dream Girls perform. And eventually they find out, they like rebuke Curtis, have a reunion concert, invite Effie back. she sings It's Like Solo at the end, and Curtis finds out that Effie has a daughter and puts together that he is her biological father. So I'm going to rate Dreamgirls 9 out of 10. Magic don't have a father.
Oh, that is a great line. Okay.
I love that line. Jennifer Hudson going, magic don't have no father.
Magic don't have no father. I'm going to rate Dreamgirls. I'm going to give it 8 out of 10. Magic don't have no fathers. And I'm going to give, again, amazing, my South Pacific rating system I figured out is 7.5 out of 10, Honey Buns. This is a very funny song in the beginning of the second act where they're like doing a Thanksgiving show, and Nelly and Billis, who is played by Danny Birdseed in this one, and he's great. But she dresses up as a soldier and he dresses up as the woman, and they do this little fun thing.
Yeah.
So that's mine, Honey Buns.
I'm scared to say this. I'm going to give South Pacific 6 out of 10 Honey Buns.
Don't be scared. I think I would go lower based not on the production, like based on the musical itself.
Yeah. I did see the same. Yeah. And I think that that production of it was really well done.
I think they do a much better
job. But as a show, I'll talk about it. But
we'll talk about it.
Let's
get right into it.
What's stopping us?
I think, and like, okay, before we do get into it, though, I was trying to think of another question that draws these together, but I, again, think I, like, obviously win, because my question was, which person handles the surprise children worse? I think Nelly obviously does.
Absolutely,
like,
yes.
Curtis doesn't handle it great, but Nelly is awful. So, again, short conversation, I win. Anyway, so let's start with South Pacific, and I think I'm just going to go through everything I have, because, like, dude,
yeah,
so much stuff. Okay. So, basically, like, in my head, this show comes down to, like, the progressive ideals it had in mind and the context of when it was made, and versus, like, the now outdated, I mean, they're outdated at the time, but now, like, very outdated stereotypes and the Orientalism of the narrative. So, I kind of want to start off with some, like, context of what South Pacific was meant to be, and like why it was like extremely controversial at the time. Like, I think it was like pretty obviously, like, Broadway loved it, it won a ton of awards, but when they went on tour, they had like a really tough time. It was like very controversial, people didn't want to see it, or like certain audiences didn't want to see it. So I just want to go into that a little bit, and then I'll get into what I like and what I don't like. So it was obviously, it came out in 1949, and then the time it was made and conceived, it was viewed as this like big confrontation of racism. And I found this quote from Professor Philip Beidler from the University of Alabama. Basically says, Rodgers and Hammerstein's attempt to use the Broadway theater to make a courageous statement against racial bigotry in general and institutional racism in the post-war United States in particular forms part of this legend. So basically, it comes off of this idea, and I think they take this idea and run with it, and I do think this is, like, kind of nice, like, the idea that if one person has a prejudice, it's a character flaw, but if two do, it tells us something about, like, what's going on in society. It tells us a greater thing. So the really famous song from the show, I mean, there are very many, like, the songs are extremely popular. But one of the famous ones is You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. And it was an extremely controversial song when it came out, and it's probably the most famous one from the show. But it basically puts forth the idea that racism is something that is passed down and learned rather than something that is inherently wrong with a person. Like, there's a big scene where Nelly is like, I don't know what's wrong with me. And then Cable basically comes in and talks with Emile about how racism is something that is learned rather than inherent in a person. So, like I said, it did really well on Broadway. And then things are kind of wacko on tour as far as people being upset about this show and this song. In Georgia, shouts to my home state, two senators like really objected to the song's inclusion in the show. They objected to the show in general. They called it like Moscow inspired. They said some really heinous shit about like mixed race people. Like, it was really heinous. And it was just like very controversial. So I do want to like, I do want to say, like, in 1949, when this came out, I think they were, like, trying to do a really good thing. And I think sometimes it works, but sometimes we need to re-examine things in the context of now. So I'll go into what I like. So one thing I really like about the show is that the main character, I'm going to focus on Nelly. This happens with Cable too, but I'm going to focus on her since she's pretty much the main one. She's extremely likable. Like, when you first meet her, she's, like, very sunny. She's very optimistic. She is very nice. She's nice to everyone around her. And she's still infected with these prejudices and still is racist and has these racist beliefs. And I think there's, like, a strong sentiment among certain well-meaning white people, which the show is probably aimed at more than anyone else, that they don't have the problem. Like, the racism isn't their problem. It lies in other people who have bad intentions, and it can't lie in people who have good intentions, who are trying to hold up these American ideals, like all men are created equal, etc. And when it comes down to it, even well-meaning people have prejudices. Like, Nelly's might be a little more, like, more stronger than, like, a lot of people. but when it comes down to it, likable people have prejudices, well-meaning people have, you know, this stuff ingrained in them. And Nelly, like, throughout the whole show is always going on about the ideals of America and how she can't believe her mother is so prejudiced. Like, her mother doesn't want her married a French guy. She's like, I can't believe my mom is so prejudiced. But when she's faced with the fact that Emil was married to and had children with a woman who is not white, her own prejudices rear their ugly heads. So I think that's a pretty progressive statement to make, especially in 1949. And then one more thing I want to get into before I get into what I don't like, which might be a longer list, is Lieutenant Cable and Leah, which is problematic, and I will explain, I'll get to why. I don't think I need to explain why. I think it's pretty understandable why. But in theory, like, he represents, and when I was doing a lot of research, they would talk about, like, what they wanted to put forth with this idea of, or with the couple of Lieutenant Cable and Leah. And in theory, like, he represents this fear that white American women had about their men becoming involved with somebody quote-unquote exotic overseas during the war. And it's, I mean, it almost rings true in this. Like, at that point, there's a point in the second act where he says, like, I'm never going back to the States, I'm staying here. But then he dies. So it doesn't actually happen. So it's not, like, not as progressive as you might like, but I understand the point they were going for. So that brings us to what I do not like, and we can continue with Leah and Lieutenant Cable, and feel free to interrupt me. I'm going to go on rants. Like, let me know your feelings.
Okay, yeah, one thing I'll say is just while you, about the things you like, is I definitely agree that the character of Nelly is really well done. And I think what's so important about it is that, especially with this show coming out in 1949, like, what they're doing with this character is showing a character that people can relate to and empathize with, who then, like, by the time it comes down to it, has to face really, really difficult truths about herself.
Yeah.
That aren't aligned with her view of how she exists, because she views her mom as this crazy, intolerant person. But when it comes down to it, she has the same problems, just, like, manifested in a different way. So I like that this show kind of, like, reels you in and like, paints her as this, as the moral, like, one in the right in the show, and then kind of flips that on its head.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
Forces, especially audiences of this time, to confront their own, like, implicit biases.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, I mean, it's great, right? Because she talks about her mom a lot and, like, how her mom's so prejudiced. And, like, she probably considers herself to be very nice to people who aren't white. But when it comes down to it, like, she doesn't want one of them to be her kid. You know, it's very, I think you're right. Like, I think that character, we'll talk about the story arc, but I think the character is, like, a pretty interesting character, especially for the time. Anyway, so let's continue with Miss Leah and Mr. Lieutenant Cable. First off, Leah is a teenager. He is not. That is rape, and it's completely framed as romantic, and she says maybe five words the whole entire musical. So mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say about that. Like, it's not good. And it shocks me that people were up in arms about the fact that they were an interracial couple and not about the fact that she was, like, 16. I couldn't find, mm-hmm. like, her exact age, but, like, most sources I could find said she's somewhere around 16. And he's probably, like, 23, 24, something like that. And it's, like, not that hard to age her up to, like, 20. Like, I don't know. It's just so ridiculous. I cannot believe that it just happens. Anyway, so that's, like, yeah. I don't know what to say about that. It's not great. And then I want to get into Bloody Mary. Oh, Bloody Mary. So I want to say, and part of what I liked about the production that I watched with Kelly O'Hara, and the actress who plays Bloody Mary in this production is named Loretta Alves Sayer. I don't know how to say her last name. I apologize. But I really liked her portrayal of Bloody Mary.
I thought she was phenomenal, yes. Honestly.
I thought that depiction was, like, way better than other ones I've remembered seeing, like, whether it was, like, I've seen the show, like, live at a couple local theaters, and I thought it was just, like, way better than, I mean, she's a professional actress, but, like, way better than anyone I've ever seen do it elsewhere. And I think the character is often played as, like, cold and plays into, like, a big dragon lady stereotype. And I think that's, like, an easy trope to play into. I mean, played on its face value, she's, like, selling off her teenage daughter to the highest bidder, or that's what it feels like, you know? And in this portrayal, I think I saw much more, like, desperation and a lot of a feeling like, well, this is my only shot to give my daughter a better life. And while that still, I think, like, kind of perpetuates, like, an Orientalist view, it is a much better portrayal than I am scary and I am trying to sell off my teenage daughter, you know?
Yeah.
It's like when she leaves them alone together, when she leaves Lieutenant Cable and Leah alone together for the first time, she's like, she looks very upset. She doesn't look happy about it. I think, again, that, like, really comes from this particular actress's portrayal, not what is really given to them. And then I found this HuffPost review. It was when the 2008 Broadway revival was circulating. It's from Rick Ayers. And it's a really long quote. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But he basically, I think he really nails, like, the kind of consensus of the review is, like, he can't understand why so many professional critics are just lauding this musical as, like, an anti-racist musical when there's so many issues with it, which I, like, very firmly agree with. Like, you can't just be like, this is anti-racist because it was in 1949. Like, we've evolved. Like, our perceptions of the world has evolved. Like, what we know has evolved. And he basically, this quote kind of describes the relationship between Bloody Mary, Liat, and Lieutenant Cable. Part of it says, so, indeed, Liat speaks not a word in the whole musical, only smiles and takes the Yankee to bed. She's underage. He's a pedophile. What a fantasy of the white Western male, the submissive, exoticized, and eroticized Asian girl to what? Well, to screw, of course. But here's the author's turn on their liberal sympathy. She is not only for screwing, but for helping Cable to get in touch with his gentle side, his body, his heart. Liat helps Joe feel younger than springtime. Yes, she is a sensual prop, and he is going through changes. He is the subject. She is the object. And I know, it's really great. Perhaps to him, but...
I love that.
Yeah.
Here are the author's turn on their liberal sympathy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, like, I think that part of the idea, again, like, was to play on this, like, that Western exoticized fantasy that he talks about, especially, I think, like, play on the white women in the audience, like, watching this, like, handsome American soldier fall for this, again, teenage fucking girl, but okay. But then he dies, so, like, they're safe. Nothing, you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't actually leave. He wants to, and then he dies. Like, what does that say, you know? But I really liked that quote, and I think it, like, sums it up quite nicely, like, the issues there. And then going into Nellie and Emile, there's another quote from that same HuffPost article where he basically talks about how, like we said, Nellie, like, comes to terms with herself and her prejudices at the end, and she ends up with Emile and his children. But, like, the end of this quote basically says the furthest that her epiphany can go is to tolerate these others. So it becomes about, like, tolerating them and not accepting them. And my other biggest issue with the show is, like, they are his literal children. He seems to love them very much. They're very cute. Like, they go around singing French songs. They're wildly adorable. And it's just crazy to me that his love for this woman could be so strong that she completely derides his children based on their race, and he doesn't give a fuck eventually. Like, he doesn't care. Like, he's like, he comes back, and they're like, oh, we're happy now. And he's like, okay, cool. I'm like, you guys never talked about that? Like, we had some real big problems. And all this, of course, like, plays into the Orientalism of the narrative in general, and, like, the representation of Asia and Asian characters from a colonialist perspective. And then this is just another quote that I think really sums that up from that HuffPost article. It goes, even in its more modern iteration, which I agree, like, I think things have been done to kind of modernize this, like I said, like with the portrayal of Bloody Mary and stuff, but even its more modern iteration, the Western narrative has a difficult time breaking from the sexual fantasy from a story which keeps the white man in the middle of things and the Asian woman on her back. So.
Woo.
Yeah, that's really all I have. I think, like, this is a show that had incredibly, like, good intentions at the time, but I think it is, like this HuffPost writer said, what's his name? Sorry, let me find it again. I want to say it. Rick Ayers. I think it is quite wild that a lot of professional theater critics are just like, well, it's against racism, and it's like, there's so much more going on that we need to, like, unpack.
Yeah.
There's so much going on.
A few things that I want to, so I really like what you were just saying about Nelly and, like, just tolerating the kids. Because one thought I was having when I watched, or when I was like, yeah, well, okay. Before I talk about this, I need to talk about my other point, which is that if I'm being totally honest, one feeling I kept feeling while I was watching this was boredom.
That's fair. It's really long. It's too long.
It's like 3 hours, and I'm gonna be honest, I didn't finish it.
I almost didn't, but I had to. So.
Yeah, to be fair, I would have, I think, if we had recorded like a few days from now, but I just like wasn't motivated to go back to it. I got about like 3/4 of the way through and I was like, okay, I'll finish later. And then I just haven't. So yeah, that's kind of like an overwhelming thing I felt, was like, I was just kind of bored. But the second thing I wanted to say about the tolerance aspect is, I feel like one type of show we've done a lot on this podcast is shows that don't have happy endings and don't tie everything up in a bow. Mm-hmm. And the point of it is to show that there's not an ending. There's like, always a next step. There's always another part of growth and challenge. And like, one thing that I would have loved, okay, I wouldn't have loved this portrayed because it would have made it longer, but one thing I kept thinking about was like, if right now she's gotten to tolerance as like, that's where she is, what kind of mother is she gonna be to these kids? Yeah. Like, she's gonna resent them. And she's going to take out her frustrations of clearly not having worked through her own shit. Like, she's going to take that out on them.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like the show wraps everything up with this bow. And I think that, like, one way that they could have made this better is to not do that and to show that show that this is the first step among many on her path to unlearning all this shit.
Yeah. I do know there were, like, when I was doing research, this is like the last of many, many, many drafts. And I think like part of it was, because I think one issue I have with the show is that it's like, oh, we're trying to make white people uncomfortable, but in the end they're gonna be comfortable. It's fine, don't worry about it. Like,
yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, Lieutenant Cable, oh my god, he likes like an Asian woman, like, oh my god, it's our worst fear come true. Oh, he dies, don't, you know, like, it like pushes it and then like pulls back. And I don't know exactly how many iterations of the draft there were, but I do believe that it was like softened a bit. Like, I know there are like a couple Nelly moments that are like much nastier in earlier drafts. So I don't know like how much they were like forced to change or like thought that they couldn't get like through to audiences with, so that's, like, something to take into consideration. But you're right, like, eventually, like, this is what they put out.
Okay, I'll talk about Dreamgirls for a bit.
Let's do it.
So, Dreamgirls, I absolutely fucking love this show. It's, like, a really big comfort show for me, mm-hmm. especially the movie. I've seen the stage version once and really thoroughly enjoyed that too. But I watched the movie and I've seen the movie like countless times.
Mm-hmm.
So one take that I have is I think that the text itself, I think it works better as a movie.
Ooh.
I'm not, but like what I actually, this might sound weird, but I'm not saying that the movie is better than the stage version. Because I do think the stage version has a lot of merits, but I do just think it, like, works better as a movie. One of the, like, aspects of the show is that over the course of the whole thing, they probably perform at, like, 30 to 40 different venues. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard to do on stage and to differentiate costuming and venues and stuff. And they, like, are able to do that, and I think much more effectively in the movie. That being said, I think both are phenomenal. But I do think that this is a, like, I don't know, I can't say Chicago level, because I think that the Chicago movie, like, so literally good. Takes it to another level.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a fantastically done movie musical adaptation. Next thing I'm going to talk about, the Jennifers.
Oh my God.
Oh my God, oh my is God. Right. I think that the two main, there have been others, obviously, but the two most prominent women that have played the lead role of Effie, Jennifer Holliday and Jennifer Hudson, legitimately, I think this was the role of a lifetime for both of them.
True.
hands down. They both bring, like, something really personal, what feels to me like is really personal and heartfelt and, like, soul-wrenching to this role. Every video I watch either of them singing songs from this character, it is just like, oh, it literally leaves me speechless. And I can't imagine that they, both of them, don't have this really intimate tie to this character.
Yeah.
Because I really think that they do. To talk, so the movie version is the one I'm most familiar with. Jennifer Hudson's, so one thing I need to say right now and out myself as is, I think I would say Jennifer Hudson has, in my mind, like, some of the top three of all time vocals. I'm not exaggerating. Like,
yeah,
musical theater, pop, any genre. Like, her voice to me is it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fucking obsessed with Jennifer Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this show showcases her talent, like, unbelievably well. And the thing that's crazy is like, in what world and in what movie can an actress, both in a way that is, like, extremely real and convincing, show that they can, like, by miles outperform Beyonce?
Like, okay, we'll talk about that, but you're right. I have a lot of thoughts about it, but yeah.
Yes. I mean, okay, and this is not Beyonce slander. I'm such a Beyonce stan.
I think she is
also phenomenal in this movie.
That's why I think...
But, like,
yep.
She clearly does outperform her, like, in... And I also think Beyonce is holding back, because that's her character.
Yeah.
But anyway, she, like, is just out here and able to, like... When they're doing, what's the song that they do when she, like, starts singing over her and, oh my God, I can't remember. Happy.
Yeah.
Happy. And she just, like, starts, like, squelching over Beyonce. And, yeah, I think that she is absolutely fantastic in this role. Mm-hmm. And which brings me to the bigger thing, which I think is the real strong suit of the show, which is the music. I think the music in this show is absolutely unreal. Like, every song, it just leaves me speechless. And it is just, like, the epitome of, like, bringing funk and Motown and, like, I just think that it's such a beautiful, beautiful score. I know I said this about Evita, before in a previous app, but this show has to be up there, or if not the show, with like one of the best Act One closers of all time. And I'm telling you,
it's ridiculous.
And again, both of those I think are both because of how well the song is written and how good it is, but also because of Jennifer Holliday and Jennifer fucking Hudson. Yeah. Like, the two of them have just set the standard that this is the musical theater song to be able to sing.
Yeah. Side note, when I was watching this the other day, it was that part, and my dad during, and I'm telling you, my dad came into the room at some like Big Bell 2 moment and was like, "Are you screaming?" And I was like, "No, it's Jennifer Hudson." And he went, "Oh," and then he like kind of just like watched it for a minute and was like, "Wow," and then he left.
Wow.
He's like, "Wow," and then he just left. I was like, "It's a good review."
Yeah, great review. Yeah. So the music, I think, yeah, as I was saying, just absolutely fantastic. I will say that the reason I gave it a 9 instead of a 10 is that I do think that there are some shortcomings in this show,
yeah,
like in its plot. I think it gets a little messy at times. It's like it clearly wants to be a show that's pretty much entirely sung through, but it's not. And so it feels a lot of times like they're just rushing through these like scenes to get to the next song, which, like, don't get me wrong, I love, because the songs are worth it. Mm-hmm. Like, they're that good that they could stand alone. But I don't know. I think because of that, as an audience member, I find myself doing the same. Like, just kind of wanting to skip through the talking portions and get to the next song to, mm-hmm, be blown away. So I think especially where that, to me, it happens is in the, like, resolutions in Act 2,
yeah,
in the second act. In both the stage version and the movie, like, I don't know. I think it's just kind of messy how everything resolves. It doesn't feel like Effie gets the, like, apology she deserves, that she gets the... Yeah, I feel like I just want a lot more for Effie, and I don't know. Like, basically, after being totally, like, manipulated and taken advantage of, and then eventually, like, becoming a single mother and going into poverty, like, all this shit... The big thing that she gets is like that she sings the last song at the reunion of the Dream Girls. Mm-hmm. And I know there's obviously like stuff that has to happen after that, but I don't know. I just wish there was a more resolution on that front. So that's why I'm giving it a 9 instead of a 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I was gonna say I think that's why I gave it an 8. Because I think, like, and I've never seen a stage version, so I'm only going off the movie, but I think you're right. Like, not the exposition, but just, like, the plot in general feels kind of rushed, and so I never felt, at least in the, like, scene moments, in the, like, speaking moments, like, I was, like, forging a real emotional connection with anyone. It felt, like, very, like, well, we have to say this because we have to get to this part. So it didn't, you know, like, it didn't really feel,
yes,
very deep. But then when they sing, I'm like, oh my God, I would die for you. So,
yes.
Yeah. So,
well, and the thing
tough.
Is, it's like,
yeah,
also, I feel like that the most, like, the transitioning through time and the growth, like, that all happens in the musical numbers. Like,
mm-hmm,
their rise to the top of the pop charts, it's like in unison to them,
yeah,
singing that song. And you see, like, you see it happen through them going through performance to performance, to music video, to, like, late night show, you know, like, shit like that, to show that this is a song going to the top. Whereas most of, like, the majority of dialogue in the show to me is, like, fights. Or,
yeah,
it's, like, it's not, like, which, again, that's not that everything has to be positive. Obviously, I'm not saying that. But it's just hard when you go from these incredibly well done, fun, upbeat musical numbers, and you're rooting for all these people, and,
mm-hmm,
then they stop, and it's just like, oh, here I get to watch, you know, fucking Curtis be an asshole,
yeah,
again,
like,
and
oh,
take advantage of these women.
Yeah, it was like, oh, Eddie Murphy is sad again. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I did not talk about Eddie Murphy enough, by the
He's
way.
He's great!
Holy fucking shit. Like, man can sing.
Yeah,
the fuck.
I was shocked. I forgot he was in this. And I, like, generally believe Eddie Murphy should be in most movies, but, like, I forgot he was in this for some reason. I haven't seen this in a really long time. I don't think I've seen it since, like, I was in high school. But, like, I was Googling, like, is he really singing in this? He's so good.
Yes, he's amazing.
Absolutely.
Okay, one thing I wanted to talk about was the similarities between this show and The Supremes. Because this feels like it just is really crazy to me that the creative team is, like, vehemently denies that it's based off The Supremes. Mm-hmm. Because here are a list of similarities between, like, the real-life events of The Supremes and this musical. Okay, both The Supremes and The Dreams started out with this is from Wikipedia, by the way.
Okay.
started with Ets in their name. So The Supremes were originally the Premettes, and The Dreams were the Dreamettes. Both The Supremes and The Dreams did background vocals first with an established recording artist before they themselves became famous. Diana Ross was literally chosen as the lead singer because of her softer commercial voice, which is the exact same reason that Dina is chosen as the lead in The Dreamgirls. The storyline of Dina and Curtis mirrors Diana Ross and Berry Gordy Jr.'s love affair. The storyline of Laurel and Jimmy Early's relationship resembles Mary Wilson's relationship with a different Motown artist that they performed with. Dina is the spokesperson for the group, just like Diana is. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there are so many similarities that it's just as, like, honestly comical to me. And more than comical, honestly, I might even say frustrating.
Yeah.
Because the creative team for this show were all white men. So, like, while I do think this show, really, I really do think this show celebrates Black people and Black women especially, I do think that it celebrates them through a white lens.
Yeah.
In that I think that they experience success in a really palatable way for white people to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So that is another critique of the show, is like, especially like in 1980s, like let me start over here.
Do it.
I don't think it's like a crime that white people wrote a show about a black women group rising to fame.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, this show would be so much, I think, more meaningful if it had come from a Black artist writing it. Because I think that a lot of things would have been done differently. And I bet that a lot of the dialogue issues might feel more authentic.
Oh my God.
I just feel like that could have solved a lot of the problems I have with this show. So I still love this show to death. And we'll continue watching it. But that's one part for me that I'm like, I really, really wish that this show had come from a Black artist.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that is probably a big reason why, like, the dialogue and the scene setting and the, like, plot, moving the plot along when it's spoken, I'm like, what are we doing here? Like, it just feels like, mm-hmm. we have to say this, and we have to go here, and, like, we have to, it all feels very, like, declarative. I don't know. It's just strange.
Yeah, and so there, one, like, thought that I have is that a lot of their music gets whitewashed a mm-hmm. bit from what they actually want to perform, because it needs to be palatable to white audiences. and to me, it feels like, in a less intentional way than was done with the music, that's the case with the dialogue. Like, it's whitewashed because it's written by white people.
Yeah.
Not because they're trying to, like, censor their language for white audiences in Dreamgirls, but because literally, like, it's written by white people. They don't have the same understanding of the experiences that these people are going through.
Wow. Could this week, the category could have been shows that shows that should have been written by a different race, or shows that where someone tried to make it palatable to white people.
Yeah, honestly, there are probably a lot more similarities now that we go through this.
For real. Wow. Well, the only last thing I wanted to say about Dreamgirls, and this isn't like that serious. I just thought it was, like, funny, and it was hard. One of the things that was hard for me is, like, everyone, like, saying Beyonce is not a good singer.
Like, yes.
I do agree with you. I think she, like, I think Jennifer Hudson has, like, she's, like, a stronger voice in a lot of ways. Like, yes. Just in, like, the power behind it, I think. And I do think Beyonce is, like, pulling back quite a bit to, like, fit the character. But there was, like, a moment where, like, the actress who was playing Dina's mom was like, I never thought my daughter had much of a voice. And I was like, are you fucking kidding?
Yeah, I know. What?
What are you talking about?
Which is funny because then, like, right after that happens, she goes into, it's, like, Beyonce's first lead. I don't remember which song it is, but she, like, just fucking destroys it.
Yeah. And it's, like, her, when there's a scene with her and Curtis.
Oh, it's Dreamgirls.
Oh,
it's the song Dreamgirls.
Yeah. But there's a scene with her and Curtis, who's Jamie Foxx, who I love, and he does a great job. But he, like, basically tells her, like, I didn't pick you because you're a good singer. You're a shit singer. And I'm like, who are you talking to? Like,
yeah.
What's going on here? it was just, like, sometimes something would happen where, like, something to that effect would be said, and I'd be like, I don't know if that's true, but fine, okay.
One other thing I wanted to say with Dreamgirls that I think is just bizarre to me is the, controversy. I don't even know if there was a controversy, but it's a controversy to me.
Okay.
So that's why I'm calling it one. of the nominations, So Jennifer Hudson won for Best Supporting Actress.
Mm-hmm.
They submitted Beyonce as lead actress.
Wait, what?
And Jennifer Hudson as supporting.
Who else?
Which is crazy because in the Tony Awards, like in the actual show, Jennifer Holliday won for Best Actress, like Best Leading Actress. But the show itself, like submit, which is so interesting because, like, to me, that defeats the whole purpose of the show. Like, the whole point is Effie is the lead, and they're taking it away from her. And it feels like that's what they did to me, personally, in the award show for the Oscars.
I'm looking to see who was nominated for Best Actress, because it might have been, like, a we want her to win ploy, you know?
Let me see. Yeah, Beyonce wasn't, for what it's worth, Beyonce wasn't even nominated for Best Actress.
Yeah, let me see. Let's see. Yeah, okay.
I think it was
a We Want Her to Win ploy.
Really?
Yeah, okay, the lead actresses, the Best Actress nominees are Helen Mirren, won for The Queen. Penelope Cruz for Volvere, Judi Dench, Notes on a Scandal, Meryl Streep, The Devil Wears Prada. Kate Winslet, Little Children. And then the Best Supporting Actress category isn't quite as stacked. So it might have been a We Want Her to Win ploy.
Okay,
but still, you're right.
I'm glad she wins.
Yeah, you're still
she
right.
Did become,
like, she's the
Jennifer
lead
Hudson
actress.
Did become, yeah. And she did become the first actress to win an Oscar in their acting debut, which I think is really
cool. That's amazing. I love her.
Yeah.
She's great. Good for her. Okay, so I guess we have bop lists left, unless you have anything else to say, and my bop list will be quite short.
I don't. Let's go into bop list.
Okay, so listen, South Pacific has beautiful orchestrations, and Rodgers and Hammerstein, kings of integration, as they say. I took a musical theater class. I know what that is, but these songs are not, perhaps, barring a few, what I would just, like, put on my musical theater playlist and press shuffle on. You know what I mean? So, I'm just gonna basically, like, say what my favorite songs are for this bop list. I love Some Enchanted Evening. I think it's beautiful. There Is Nothing Like a Dame is an actual bop. That's a good time. Bali High, I think, is actually quite beautiful.
Yeah, I love Bali High.
Bali High is great. I'm not going to say I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair because I don't like that song. I think it's annoying, but that's fine. I think A Wonderful Guy is an absolutely amazing song. And fun fact about this show that I didn't mention before, but I think A Wonderful Guy quite accurately portrays. So it was the first time Rodgers and Hammerstein had, like, a belting female lead. And that's based on Wikipedia. So, like, who knows? But I, like, looked back through it. So it's, like, Carousel. And then, oh God, what was the other one? Oklahoma, which are both like soprano female leads.
Yeah.
So it was the first time they had like an actual kind of like, she has the belt a little bit. And it's great. So,
a little bit.
Yeah. But like way more than like fucking Oklahoma, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And I think A Wonderful Guy is a great song. I really love that song. Younger Than Springtime, problematic as fuck, but nice music. Yeah, I told you it's gonna be short. And then, okay, this is the last thing I'll say, because this is the last song on my bop list. This Nearly Was Mine, I think, is one of the most, and the context of it, again, I've said, I don't understand why he's so in love with this woman who hates his children, but fine. This Nearly Was Mine is, I think, one of the most, like, emotionally beautiful, like, songs of longing that I've ever heard in my entire life. And Paulo, again, Sazot, don't know how to say his last name, I apologize. He does a wonderful job, but I implore you, if you have never seen the Brian Stokes Mitchell performance of this song, it is one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. He had no reason to go as hard as he does, yet he did. And he is so emotionally invested in it. I've never seen someone like look that in touch with what they're singing, and like it's just like coming through him. Like he's not trying, it's just inside of him. And it's really, really beautiful. You need to look it up. It's amazing. Yeah, that's all I have to say.
I'll plus one that.
Yeah. It's amazing. All right. That's mine.
Okay, Dreamgirls bop list.
Much longer.
Okay. Yeah, it is. Move. Fake Your Way to the Top, Cadillac Car, both fucking versions.
Oh,
I
man.
Said it. So, okay, I have some tea about the other version. First of all, I really do love so if you don't know, there's Cadillac Car and then there's the reprise. And Cadillac Car is this new single by the Dreamettes at the time. It's before the Dreamgirls. It's with Jimmy Early and the Dreamettes. And like right after it's released, it's like done and basically stolen by like a white artist, and it's this really like exaggeratorily white version, and it's done by Rory O'Malley, who was in Book of Mormon, and fucking Laura Bell Bundy is one of the background girls. And I just think it's a really funny and like extremely clear way to show cultural appropriation in a way that like anyone can understand. Anyway. Fun story about the white version of Cadillac Car. I'm not going to name names, but I do know someone who had one song from Dreamgirls downloaded onto their iTunes.
It was the white version.
And it was the white version of Cadillac Car.
Oh my God.
Which that feels offensive. That's not going to lie.
That is like a hate crime. What the hell?
Yes. Anyway, back to the bop list. Step Into the Bad Side. Oh, fuck yeah. Love You, I Do. Oh, by the way, I'm doing a movie bop list because the movie adds a few songs that I love.
Okay.
I Want You, Baby, Family, Dream Girls, Oh My God, Heavy, It's All Over, and I'm Telling You, of course. Ooh. Patience, second act. I Am Changing, that's my actual favorite song in the show. I'm obsessed with that song. I Meant You No Harm / Jimmy's Rap. I love Jimmy's Rap, even though it's kind of him like going through a breakdown. One Night Only disco version, the time it's stolen by the Dreamgirls on accident, on their end.
Yeah.
Listen, best song added to a musical and a movie version ever, I might say. And then Dreamgirls finale. So most songs in the show to me are bops.
Wow. Great. Well, should we get to our little recreate?
Shall we recreate our last recreate the first season?
I'm gonna cry. Oh, man.
You already did that two episodes ago. You can't again.
I do it every day, so. All right. I'll start, and mine is more serious to commemorate our last one. So I tried to think about, because South Pacific is a show, again, I said I think it has, like, really honorable intentions. It just fucks up a lot. And like, I mean, 1949, I guess it makes sense. But so I was trying to think of ways that like you could possibly like change aspects of the show. Like, not that anyone will. It's like one of those classic things, whatever. But trying to think of ways you could change the show to make it feel a little more updated. And I mean, I am just one white girl from Atlanta. I'm trying my best. So, and like, I think it's kind of ironic because like the problem with the show is Orientalism. So I think like I tried my best and this is what I came up with. So let's give it a shot.
Let's go.
So the first thing I think would make it better is giving Bloody Mary a little more, like, more room to show what she feels, not just through, like, implying what she feels, like, actually being able to say it. Not that, like, you need to, like, say things to be able to portray what you feel, but, like, most of her actual dialogue is, like, not incredibly complex.
Five words.
Yeah. No, that's Liot. But Bloody Mary, like, she talks a lot. It's My bad. No, we'll get to Liot. But so, a lot of the more positive reviews I read of, like, portrayals of Bloody Mary's character talked about the desperation and the lack of choices that she has, which is a fair assessment. And I think, again, in this particular production, the actress really put it through. But I think, again, like, that interpretation has to be put into the character by the actress playing the part. It's not necessarily there as strongly as you might believe. So I think you could fix that by kind of changing the storyline a little bit. So we're supposed to believe that Bloody Mary thinks Liot's best chance at a better life is marrying this American officer. Yet this American officer in question, Cable, would, as far as I can tell, I mean, someone please correct me if I'm wrong, but this, I just watched it, this is what I got. He would have to stay there for that to happen. Or at least he implies that he is, like, gonna stay on the island and not go back to America and marry her before he dies. And far be it from me to correct Rodgers and Hammerstein, but I think it would be more interesting if Bloody Mary isn't so, like, gung-ho about the marriage to Cable, and it becomes more like Liot's decision. So there's a point in the show where Bloody Mary, once Cable is like, no, I can't marry her, she's like, well, she's gonna marry this French planter instead, this rich French planter. And considering both marriage options would lead Liot to stay where she is, just have, like, a better life either way, I guess. It's just interesting to me that Bloody Mary would, like, push the notably poorer, probably, American soldier, which I think is kind of, like, a very American frame to look at that, to think that would be the best option, other than this, like, rich-ass French planner. Anyway. So I think, like, it would be more interesting if Bloody Mary perhaps was, like, pushing this marriage to the French planner on her daughter, and then her daughter, which leads me to my second change, which is aging up Liot and giving her more agency. So if Bloody Mary is pushing, like, this French planner option on her daughter, perhaps her 21-year-old daughter, not 15, meets Cable of her own volition in some way that doesn't involve her mother pushing them to have sex, and they fall in love organically and appropriately, and then the push and pull becomes Bloody Mary not wanting Liot to leave her, and not wanting her to go off with, I'm assuming, a considerably poorer American option, perhaps more dastardly too, and Liot actually being in love with this man and not wanting to stay on the island and, like, fall in love with this rich planter, if that makes sense. And then, like, Cable wouldn't die, they would leave together, and I think that, for 1949, would probably be a little more daring in the sense that it doesn't, like, again, buy into the white American woman's fear of, like, a man falling in love with a woman far away from home, quote-unquote. And hopefully, like, the new version would, like, give Liot enough choice in the matter that it doesn't serve as, like, an exoticization of a young Asian woman. So just, I think, like, giving, perhaps, like, playing up the relationship between Bloody Mary and Liot more, and, like, showing that desperation of wanting your daughter to have a better life, and then, like, giving Liot more agency to, like, fall in love with who she chooses, and also, you know, maybe being, like, 20 years old or so. So I hope that will give, like, both women more explicit reasons to express their desires and, like, make the choices they do. And then the other thing, it's pretty short, I don't think Nellie and Emile should end up together. So I think it'd be better to, like, switch who ends up together in this point. So, like, Cable doesn't die. Liat's older. Maybe they end up together. They leave. And it's just always bothered me that Emile, like, simply allows Nelly's, quote-unquote, tolerance of his children to serve as an excuse, basically. I think your potential stepchildren are not something that should be tolerated. They should be loved. And I, like, if they have a child on their own, a fully white child, like, she's gonna favor that child so much.
Yeah.
I just, yeah, I think it would be, and again, I don't know what happened in the other drafts, but I think it would be better if they didn't end up together. Yeah.
I love that. I would have loved to seen a scene where Emile comes out and says, like, your tolerance is not enough.
Yeah.
You know, like,
it'd be great.
Something along those lines.
Yeah. But those are my ideas. Wow. Yeah.
I love those ideas.
Thanks.
I love those ideas, and one I would add is to just, like, cut some of the fat.
I was about to say, it is quite long. Like, and I think there are, I didn't even really get into, like, all the Billis stuff and, like, the American soldier masculinity sexuality stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack. We could talk for hours.
There really is.
But, yeah.
Wow, I love your last recreate.
Well, thank you.
My last recreate is not a serious one, but I'm
That's
happy
okay.
with it.
I'm excited.
So, okay, one thing I talked about quite a bit was how this show has a lot of parallels with The Supremes. Mm-hmm. Well, another connection that I think can be made to this chain is that I think that Destiny's Child has a lot of parallels to Dreamgirls.
Oh my gosh.
And not just because Beyonce is an anchor between the two. So I do think that in less, like, exact ways than there are between The Supremes and the show, I do think there are a lot of similarities between the, like, rise of Destiny's Child and the rise of the Dreamgirls. So what I decided to do was to imagine if we had to, like, replace some songs in Dreamgirls with, like, a jukebox musical version with Destiny's Child songs, how I would do that.
Oh my god.
And since this show has both songs by the Dreamgirls but also by the individual members of the Dreamgirls, I wanted to do as, like, fair play, not just Destiny's Child songs, but also if it's, like, as if it's a solo by one of the characters in Dreamgirls, I can use the songs of the parallel artist. So Beyonce or Kelly Rowland, because I'm sorry, Michelle, but I don't. Yeah.
Wow. Come for Logan online.
I mean, yeah, fair enough.
Damn.
I stand by it. Okay, so I'm not going to do every song, but I have about eight that I'm doing. So the song Move, that's one of their, like, big break songs. I would replace that with Independent Women, Destiny's Child song. Cadillac Car, that's a song kind of about them, like, flaunting what they got. So I would replace that with Bootylicious. Instead of flaunting that car, they're flaunting that booty.
As you will.
Step Into the Bad Side, I would replace with... Sorry.
Oh my god.
I just realized that I used the same Destiny's Child song twice.
That's
back
okay.
to back without even noticing. Whatever, I'm standing by it because I love the song enough for it to be in the show twice. Step Into the Bad Side, Jump In.
Uh-huh.
Family. I don't know how I did this. This might have been just like I'm copy and pasted wrong or something. For Family, I also said Jump In.
Alright. That works.
Fair enough. Dreamgirls, I said Say My Name.
Mm.
Because they're like, Say My Name, mm-hmm. Dreamgirls.
Yeah.
and that one will come back, by the way.
Okay.
For Heavy. So this is the song where it's the group song, but it's where Jennifer Hudson, like, tries to take over the song and, like, out belts Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
So the so what I did here was Motivation by Kelly Rowland.
Ooh. I like it.
It's All Over into and I'm Telling You, which I kind of consider that to be the same song because it just flows together.
Mm-hmm.
What I did here was Effie's character to me obviously is Beyonce and Destiny's Child.
Mm-hmm.
like talent wise, even though I do love Kelly and Michelle. So I did a little three songs back to back into each other that I feel like carry the same energy of It's All Over and I'm Telling You. Okay. So I have Pray You Catch Me into Sandcastles into Formation.
Oh my God.
Woo, wow. And also, like, could you imagine that ending an act of a musical?
No, I'd be dead on the floor.
Yeah. I Am Changing, I would do Flawless, Beyonce's, kind of like owning her growth. This one I'm happy with. One Night Only. So this is the song where there is the Effie, she starts it, but then there's a disco cover that the Dreamgirls do and they steal it. So this would be One Night Only to One Night Only Disco is Soldier by Destiny's Child to Soldier, the homecoming version. Because Beyonce is way more the lead in that version, but they all do it again at homecoming. Listen by Beyonce. So Kelly Rowland is actually the Beyonce.
Okay.
Not obviously she's not Beyonce. Beyonce is the Beyonce of Destiny's Child, but Kelly Rowland is the Dina who is played by Beyonce. Okay. So Listen would be Confessions by Kelly Rowland, my favorite Kelly Rowland song. And then the Dreamgirls finale would be also from Homecoming, which is Say My Name, Homecoming Edition.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that's my recreate, redoing Dreamgirls with Destiny's Child music. Beyonce and Kelly Rowland music.
The world needs more Destiny's Child music. Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
That was great. Couldn't agree more.
Wow. Well, this brings us to the end of season one of Rate, Debate, Recreate.
I can't believe it. So
I can't either.
So what we were going to do, we discussed this prior, was like, I think when we come back, which will probably be a few months, you know, it's the holidays. I'm in the process of a move. You gotta take a break.
Me too, or I will be in a couple months.
Yeah. But we will come back with musicals again. But we wanted to hear from y'all. If there are any musicals we didn't cover that you want us to cover, you can let us know. How can they let us know, Logan?
So, you can let us know by going to our Instagram at RateDebateRecreate. look at us, our marketing skills.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so what we're going to have is on our Instagram, I'm going to have a Instagram story that allows you to submit shows that you want us to do on the second season. And then we're going to take all of the shows that are suggested. And in general, we'll add them to our list of like shows to consider, but we're going to have Instagram voting polls between shows, and the two that get to the finals and the most votes, Sammy and I will, do at some point, as a standalone episode during the second season. So this will be like category is fan voted shows or something like that.
Yeah. And then that poll will be the day we release this podcast, correct?
Yes, okay. Which will be
when we release the 31st. It. It's December 31st. Yes. December 31st. The last 31st. Day of the year. Yeah, the very last day of the year.
Wow, we didn't even time that on purpose, but we literally did this. Wow.
New Year's Eve, baby. Also, if you are so inclined, you can follow us on Twitter at RateDebate1. That's our Twitter handle. It's fun stuff.
And TikTok.
RateDebateRecreate. Which we haven't been doing recently, but we should definitely start that up again. It was fun.
Maybe season two. We'll get that back.
Yeah, we'll get that TikTok back, baby. Well, it's...
It's been an amazing season one, Sammy.
It's been a dream.
I can't believe we literally did this.
I know. We've been talking about it for so long and finally did it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, if you made it to the end of season one, I have nothing to say, but are you okay? Also... Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm so appreciative, for real. You're the real ones. If you didn't just, you know, pity listen to me once, but you're actually keeping up. If you do, I want to know who you are. Even if we're not friends right now, let's become friends. Message us on Instagram. We'll make something happen.
Yeah, seriously, message us on Twitter too, because that's what I handle, and I'm not that good at social media, but I love to be your friend as well. So please hit us up. You guys rock, all however many of you. I don't know, but this is great.
This is great.
It's great. Logan, it's been a treat.
Well, should we sign off with our own rendition of our theme song?
I guess we can. Wow, this is on the spot. Okay, okay, ready?
Ready? I'm going to count us in.
Are you going to do the theme music? Dun.
I'm going to count us in and we're going to do it.
Okay, cool.
We're just going to sing it.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
5, 6, 7, 8. Great.
Debate.
Recreate.
Rape. All right. That was perfect. Bye.
Bye.
Oh my god. That was great.
Oh my god.
Great.